if they can't give you answers to all those questions, which they're not going to be able to because they're using the wrong method, then don't use them. Because tell them you're pretending to be a brain surgeon, but you're actually a chiropractor, and I need brain surgery.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.
Think about all of the financial decisions we make about our education, careers, marriages, retirement ages, social security, taxes, investments. I could go on. They all affect our standard of living, but most of us make these decisions by relying on crude rules of thumb, where we take questionable advice from friends and family, self-described experts and advisors, who are frequently little more than self-interested salespeople. There's obviously a problem with what I'm describing, don't you think? That's why I wanted to talk to noted economist and New York Times bestselling author Larry Kotlikoff on his new book, Money Magic, which distills his best personal advice to increase your spending power and enhance your standard of living. If you've ever felt like you could be living better or making better financial decisions, I think you'll enjoy this one. So let's jump right in.
Larry, welcome to Future Proof.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, no, great to have you. I know we're going to have some of this in the intro, but I was curious from your perspective, always good to hear directly from the source. Who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis? How do you define yourself?
So I'm a professor of economics at Boston University. I work on a whole range of different topics, carbon taxation to banking reform, but a lot of work on public finance, like taxes, deficits, Social Security, and macroeconomic issues about growth. But a big part of my research has been on personal finance, and I started a software company. I'm the president about 29 years ago. It has a tool called Maxify.com, Xifi.com, which does economics-based financial planning. It's for the public to use. We sell it. It's not free, but it's not super expensive. And the idea is to convey what economics has to say and that about how to do your financial planning, how to make financial decisions. And the economic approach is almost at right angles to conventional approaches. And that led me to the book Money Magic that I wrote, that just was recently published, which was to convey for people that don't want to run software what we economists think they should be doing.
And I think it's so interesting and great, by the way, that you have somebody who wrote this who seems to have an underpinning of not just what are the right decisions to make on some level, but also understands why people don't necessarily make the right decisions. And I definitely can put myself in that bucket, if I'm being honest. Why are we so bad with money in general?
The industry is very much geared to making us bad with money. For example, it's not pushing us to save more. It's trying to figure out how we can somehow get through retirement by saving what we are saving, by retiring early, because most of us are doing that, and by making a killing on the market. And that will turn out to be bad for many people because there's no guarantee. There's the industry, Wall Street, is telling us that the stock market is safe in the long run. There's no evidence whatsoever of that in the data or in economic theory. And yes, if you just leave money untouched for a long period of time, the probability that you'll end up with a bigger, pretty high pile of money in the stock market goes up, but the probability that you'll end up running out, losing everything, also goes up. And the probability that you lose everything goes up the longer you hold it in the market. So the industry is working against us. We've got the government taking a huge amount of our money in payroll taxes and saying the Social Security is going to be there when the trustees report is showing that the system has an unfunded liability of 2.5 years of GDP. It's in the red to the tune of 2.5 years of GDP in Table 6F1, which they've conveniently hidden in the back of the appendix of the trustees report.
But I'm actually glad that you mentioned that, just because I think that's also one of those things that I feel like nobody's really talking about. It's like, how can you actually count on a thing that you shouldn't, you know, be counting on? If you were to follow all of the evidence, it seems to indicate like that's not actually a safe bet to assume that one is going to have that.
That's not safe. So we're not being encouraged really to save much more. We've got our employers have been given the control over our saving through these 401k plans, which many of us don't participate in or don't participate enough in. They're controlling their the incentives to contribute. They're through the matching contributions. They're controlling how we can invest. They're controlling the fees, therefore, that we're paying. And the whole entire retirement account experiment, I think, has been a failure because you have most baby boomers are showing up in retirement with only about 3 years of median spending. So their assets are far too low. But in other words, a lot of people have been encouraged to not save more, to depend on Uncle Sam, to depend on their employer. And that hasn't worked out. And then you've got a lot of people that aren't participating in 401ks or work for employers that don't offer retirement plans whatsoever. This is a mess. And
I was going to say, it feels like to me a perfect storm of a number of different things that are all converging to, and I don't know if this is me being, I'm generally not positive, but I almost wonder if people are a little bit more potentially receptive to the messages that you're putting out because we're so screwed. And I'm just saying, like, writ large at society, because there's so many people who are so close to the edge, they can't afford like an unexpected medical bill here or there. And maybe at least the positive is people are waking up to the fact that they need to be listening to just making better decisions.
Yeah, I think they need to be listening to economists. And Money Magic, my book, is really trying to figure out ways to bail people out by finding safe ways for them to raise their living standard that doesn't correspond to making a killing on the market. I mean, I'll give you an example. If you take Social Security at 70, the benefit is 76% higher adjusted for inflation than if you take it at 62. Most people are almost 85% are taking it too early. Only 6% are taking it at 70. There's a huge amount of money being thrown away, left on the table by making that basic mistake when it comes to when to collect Social Security. Yeah, you could die early and not see a penny of the money. On the other hand, if you die, you're transported to heaven and you don't need money.
It's a good way of thinking about it.
Yeah, when you need money is when you make it to 100, you keep living and refuse to die. And that's a huge financial risk. We're not going to die on, there's no guarantee we're going to die on time. And this is the other thing Wall Street has been focusing our attention on, our life expectancy, which is completely irresponsible because with any risk like automobile risk insurance, we look at the catastrophic outcome. With a homeowner insurance, we look at our house burning down. Here we need to look at the worst case scenario, which is we live to 100, our maximum age of life. That's what economics-based planning says to do. And when you do that, you have to save a whole lot more and then consider retiring a whole lot later than you want. So, yeah, so being smart on Social Security, being smart on retiring later rather than earlier, because retiring too early can be financial suicide. Then there's decisions about housing. Can you downsize? Can you move to a state with a lower or zero income tax?
Sorry, I just was going to say, I think what's interesting about what you're saying, and I think this is what I find interesting in the book and also just from the economists that I speak to, is that they're very good at having kind of a pragmatic, they're good at excising bias as much as possible, or at least acknowledging it, which seems to me one of the ways that people make better decisions about the future. And I think one thing I want to ask you is, why do you think we have in the, you know, day-to-day folks, everyday folks that you speak to, why do we have such little understanding of how our financial decisions impact our standard of living? Because it seems like that's something that you do really well. I've seen, like, in your Forbes column, I'm saying in the book, is like drawing a connection between A and B. And it seems as human beings, we're not really good at connecting the dots between this decision that we make and what the net impact is going to be on our economic outlook.
Yeah. In the book, I talk about just using use simple arithmetic from grade school to get a handle on how much you should be spending and how much you should be therefore saving. Your saving is your income minus your spending. So if we know your spending and we know your income, your labor income and your asset income, we can figure out how much you should be saving. And you can also see that in these kinds of arithmetic calculations that if you retire 3 or 5 years earlier, you're going to have to save a whole hell of a lot more than would otherwise be the case. You get to see the price of these decisions. So economics approaches four things. One is figuring out a sustainable spending level, given your lifetime resource. So it's lifetime budgeting. It's figuring out how to safely raise your living standard without having to rely on Wall Street to pay you, to bail you out. So raising the living standard, so securing, finding a stable spending path and figuring out how to make it higher, then figuring out how much lifestyle decisions like retiring early impact your living standard so you can make intelligent decisions, or getting divorced or getting married. How much, you know, should I marry Joe? I really don't like Joe that much, but my living standard is going to go up by a factor of 3. Maybe it's worth it. Okay, but you need to know, you can make that calculation. So there's a chapter called Marry for Money. There's a chapter called Don't Borrow for College. A chapter called Divorce Without Divorce War. There's a chapter on My Daughter the Plumber, that maybe becoming a plumber will be beats becoming a doctor in terms of lifetime income. Career choice is very important. So there's that. So there's the pricing of these lifestyle decisions.
I think, you bring up to me like another important point, which is, who are people going to for advice? Because it seems to me that people think a lot about what are the news sources that they're going to make up their mind about what's going on in the world. They'll consume a lot of different news sources when it comes. And to some extent, some of that news is just entertainment. They're not really making actionable decisions off of it. But then when it comes to finance, there are some people who will just post a question on Facebook and then they'll just see who answers, which is a little bit crazy because those might not be the most informed people. There are some people who go to a financial planner who a friend recommended. They never necessarily audit them and figure out if they're following the right advice. So I'm wondering, how do people make sure that they're making good decisions if they don't know necessarily where to look? And how should people be making decisions? I'm going to guess you're not very pro just posting a question on social media and then following the first 3 people who respond.
I'm the only economist, frankly. I started my company 29 years ago. It takes a long time to get every little detail of Social Security, which is an incredibly complicated system with 13 benefits, every detail of every single state's income tax, the ones that have income taxes, Medicare Part B premiums, the fact that high-income people can be taxed at very high levels based on what their modified adjusted gross income was 2 years earlier. So getting everything all the details, but also getting the algorithm to work in a half a second. So there aren't a lot of ways to get the answer apart from either buying our software, Maxify.com, or buying the book, Money Magic, and looking at the examples that I've run. The book's not all about the software, but it is about I try and use everything I learned from running the software over 29 years to convey. So if there were 30 economists out there conveying the economics approach, I would say, hey, here's a list of all the economists on all their software tools and all their books. But frankly, economists have bailed on this because putting together software for the public that the industry is not interested in buying because it's not part of their bait and switch methodology for selling product. But it's much easier to be an economist, sit at your desk and write some theoretical paper and think that you don't have an obligation to society in general. You're getting paid a very high salary to basically twiddle your thumbs and write papers that the public in general are not going to benefit from.
But it's funny that you said that, because in some ways, yeah, you're right. There's that kind of ivory tower mentality of putting something out there that you view as the truth, but not necessarily putting it out there in front of people and then letting it inform the decisions that they make. And I think what's interesting is that I know that you touch upon this a little bit. There are financial advisors, right, that have, they're, to an extent, they're salespeople. They have some type of inherent bias in the things that they're saying to you. I'm not saying that they're bad people. It's just that there is an inherent bias that seems that, of course, people are incentivized towards not being fired, if you will. When I ran a digital marketing agency, the inherent bias is to say that you still need us and that digital marketing works for you. So how do we acknowledge those biases when we're talking to somebody who's giving us advice?
Well, I would say see if they're giving you a plan that is going to, in black and white, show you that you're spending in today's dollars through the rest of your days per household member, your living standard per household member, discretionary spending is sustainable. And see if they are going to give you ways to raise that sustainable level of your living standard. See if they're going to be able to tell you if you retire 3 years earlier, how much that's going to impact your living standard. See if they're going to show you, if you invest this way, what's the chance that your living standard 20 years from now will be 30% below where it is today. If they can't give you answers to all those questions, which they're not going to be able to because they're using the wrong method, then don't use them. Tell them you're pretending to be a brain surgeon, but you're actually a chiropractor. And I need brain surgery. I don't need chiropractory. So I have big complaints about the financial industry. I think the financial planners themselves are really decent, great people, the ones I've run into, who are stuck with crappy tools that gives the wrong answer. And they may be applying common sense to try and get to trying their best with these crappy tools. But I also have a big complaint with my fellow economists because they think that our profession should be all about describing household behavioral mistakes, as opposed to when it comes to personal finance. We have this whole field now, behavioral finance, which is a whole industry of papers, people doing the ways in which people make stupid mistakes. And I think our obligation is not to study mistakes, but just to tell people the answer. Here's what you do, because we're all stupid when it comes to these decisions because they're too complicated for our brains. We're all completely stupid. No economist is going to do a better job than the typical person in the street in figuring out these decisions without making the right calculations themselves. And so we need to go from being a descriptive to a prescriptive profession. It's almost like doctors would study disease and never prescribe any medication. That's the situation we have with economics today. And that's why I've been on a mission for many years now to change that.
I actually told two people that I was talking to you, and they had more specific questions about two things we actually talked about more recently. So two last questions for you, okay? One of them is with retirement trends and also tied in with people living longer. Granted, life expectancy came down temporarily. It's likely to go back up. You touched upon this before, but how long should people be anticipating that they live individually? Should people factor in, well, somewhat obese and I have pre-existing conditions, therefore I should be planning in a certain way? Or should people just say, let me just assume best case scenario and prepare accordingly?
You really should consider your best case, which is really your worst case financial, which is you live to your maximum age. So you have to figure out what's the, you know, maybe it's for most people 100, for some people it might be 90 since they have so many pre-existing conditions, but it's certainly not the life expectancy. And then what economics says is it says don't blindly assume you're going to live to 100 no matter what your maximum age, but rather take an educated gamble if you're not super risk averse about having your living standard decline and plan to spend more while you're younger and less when you're older. So think about a plan whereby your living standard will gradually decline by, let's say, 0.5% starting from 70, and by 100, it's down 20% from what it was at 70. So if you're not super adverse to having your living standard decline, you could have a floor that gradually declines. That could be part of your planning. And that's how you take a little bit of a gamble here about not making it to 100. So it's not that that economics says you're going to plan for sure to live to 100. It says your planning horizon has to be 100 because you might live that long if that is your maximum age of life, and not could be 90. But then given now we got your planning horizon right, let's figure out how to spend within that. And that's where taking an educated gamble makes sense.
Well, it's funny because speaking about educated gambles, the other question I was actually talking with somebody about, one of my kind of insane ideas that then they pushed back on, and I want you to say who's right. I was talking with a longtime listener about the idea of college, and you mentioned about whether or not one should take out for college and so on and what the benefit of that is. I'm almost thinking with my daughter, who will go to college in about 10 years, that at that point, the cost will be so much that if I could, let's say, afford the best possible school with that cost the most, maybe it actually just makes sense to invest in a startup over a 4-year period of hers, a startup idea of hers when she's 18, rather than college. And of course, it's like a little bit of an insane idea, but the idea being that the costs are just so high that one shouldn't spend the most possible because it's probably a lower ROI. But where do you net out on that? I think I know.
I'm with you. I think that colleges, I sent my two boys to Oberlin College thinking that this would make them most happy. And at age 18, when they went, that's a lovely small college, great teaching. They've done well coming out of college, but they could have gone to Boston University for free tuition. And I could have accumulated all that money for them and given it to them when they graduated. They might have made, in retrospect, they tell me that would have been a better move if I had forced them to go to BU. But being a soft-hearted dad, I felt I didn't want to coerce them into going to BU because that wasn't. So I think I made a mistake on their behalf. So I do think we have to look very carefully at the cost of college. We should not be having our kids borrow for college when 40% of them don't make it through college. That's just a non-starter. It's so crazy. Risky. There are a lot, 3,000 colleges and universities in the country. There's plenty that are less expensive than others. And you can also take courses online. You can go to a community college. As I talk about it in the book, what if you're interested in getting a job with IBM in quantum computing? You take 20 online courses, having attended maybe Merrimack Community College at $10,000 a year that you can pay for the McDonald's job in the summer without any student debt, and you do well in these courses, you get grades, you get certificates, you take them at Stanford, MIT, Harvard, Boston University, we have online courses, and then you present those 20 certificates to IBM upon graduation. Are they going to hire you, or are they going to hire the BA in English from Williams College, who has $300,000 in debt?
Right. And I think that kind of stems, it kind of goes back to the idea of the more rational decisions. And it seems to me that there's somebody who, let's say, is going to a private school, a high school in New York, and they're competing with everybody who they went to high school with for bragging rights about who got into Penn versus Princeton and so on. And that's not necessarily the person who you're going to be looking to impress 4 years from then. You're probably going to be thinking about IBM, trying to impress them as an employer. So it's almost like we're grading things. We're thinking about the wrong things. So when we're making decisions, and it might be about prestige that doesn't necessarily pay off in the end.
Yeah, I got to laugh on this one. I write a column for CNBC. They asked me to start writing, and they keep putting it in the headline rather than saying Boston University economist says X. They put in Harvard trained economist says X. Harvard apparently is clickbait, and I've told them to stop this. I think they will, or I'm not going to keep writing for them. But clearly that has a cachet, that name. I did go to Harvard, but I'm 71. I went to Harvard in my 20s. This is ridiculous to be referring to. But I talk in the book about kids who go to Harvard. A lot of these kids don't do particularly well coming out of Harvard. They might be wearing their Harvard sweater all summer long and thinking that that's going to get them promoted and secure their future. But it's not the case. I saw lots of kids in grad school. Half the kids in my grad school class at Harvard didn't get through. The smartest two kids, as I discussed in the book, with fake names to protect their identities, but neither of them graduated. Neither of them got through the program with a PhD because they didn't have the tenacity, the work ethic to really get anywhere. So Harvard collects hard work in general, collects hardworking, creative people. It doesn't make them creative or hardworking. And that's true of schools in general.
And I say this in jest, but knowing the fact that I've lectured at Harvard a few times, now I know that I can get that in a headline. This Harvard lecturer says, but in all seriousness, you're right. It is great that you spend the time to educate people on not just, like you said, it's not about why we make bad decisions. It's about how to actually make better decisions and connect the dots. And I thought it was a really fantastic read. So I'm hoping as many people as possible wind up picking up Money Magic. And yeah, Larry, this was fantastic. Thank you so much for making the time.
Yeah, anytime. I'd love to come back and chat some more. It's been a great talking with you.
Thanks again to Larry for making the time. If you like what you just heard, and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to our producers, Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.